This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and everybody get ready. This is going to be a fun episode. We talk to scientists and engineers all the time, but today we are going to be looking at engineering through the eyes and brain of an engineering educator.
Ooh, this is going to be very interesting. So what problem are we solving today?
How do engineers think?
How do engineers think? I think that I'm really going to like this episode, aren't I, Jeff? Who is our guest?
This is going to be fun. Today we have Dr. Corey Hixon. He is an assistant professor of engineering at Colorado Christian University.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Corey.
Thank you both for having me.
I get very excited when we have engineers on the show because it's a different way of thinking and looking at things, you know? So we're just going to dive right in. Tell us what kind of engineer you are and kind of like, where did you start? Did you always want to be an engineer?
So I can't say I always wanted to be an engineer, but what I can say is that I definitely always wanted to fix things and tinker with things and play with things and adjust things. So a little tiny story. We got our first computer, right? So this is in, I would say 90s, like in the 1990s. And I said to my mom, I was like, I'm going to take this apart. And my mom looked at me with these gigantic eyes and she said, you're going to do what?
Right? And I said, they were expensive back then.
Yes. So I took the whole computer apart and I figured out how to put it back together and everything went kind of fine. There were like some, you know, rattles and clicks and things there, but everything still worked. And now I still am the support person as far as that goes. But so what kind of engineer? So I'm actually an engineering educator. So It's a little bit different because my focus and my emphasis is on teaching students like yourselves, right? Like the listeners to the show, how to become an engineer and what it means to become an engineer and what it's like when you go out into the workforce.
Yes, that is super cool. I love that your PhD is that. Just before we clicked record, you were telling us about what your master's work and your undergraduate work was in. Do you mind sharing that with our audience?
Of course. So for the folks listening, right, if you want to, you know, teach at a university, it takes a lot of schooling to teach at a university. Yes. So if you're interested in doing that and you're interested to teach at a college or a university level, you start off with a bachelor's degree. So my bachelor's is in engineering science from Penn State. So engineering science, If you smush together mechanical, electrical, and then material science engineering, and you kind of push them all together, you get that degree. So it's not as deep in any of them. So it's a little bit lighter there, but at the same time, you get a good broad perspective. I got into my master's degree in industrial and systems engineering because basically in my mind, and ever since I was a little kid, I wouldn't have said it this way before that, but ever since I was a little kid, there are inputs, there are processes, and there are outputs. And that's the way my brain always worked into things is things come into the system. Yep. I process them and then hopefully they go out better than they came in. And then while I was getting my master's degree, I went back for the PhD and I got my master's degree while I was doing that. So I said, well, I'm really passionate about teaching. So I want to learn how do we teach engineers in a better way and in a different way. So my PhD is actually in engineering education.
I see the world as a system too, which is, I guess, maybe unique. I don't know. I graduated from the Naval Academy. So everybody there gets 3 years of engineering. So throw that on top of my 4-year degree in chemistry. So I'm practically a chemical engineer. Yes. I mean, I don't know how that happened. But you learn so much about systems. And what I love is your question is, how do engineers think? So can you break down a little bit about how do they think and how do they approach things?
Absolutely. So one of the big things I want to get across to the listeners and get across to the folks who are thinking about going in engineering is engineering doesn't necessarily mean that you sit down and you design the case of an iPhone, or you sit down and you design this widget or this hammer or this thing. That is a type of engineering. That is actually a very specific type of engineering. So engineering is a combination of a couple different things, right? So it's a combination of what we would call engineering design, right? So thinking in terms of design, and particularly engineering design, not design in general, but engineering design. And then there's systems engineering or systems thinking, right? So you would do systems type work. And then there is creating value, right? Because we as engineers typically think if we're not creating value out of what we're doing, or there's not some utility out of what we're doing, then really should we be doing it? That's kind of the way we're ingrained to teach. So it's combining those three things: design, systems, and then the third one is creating value. So that's the way in general, I think an engineer thinks. Now I can go into any one of those if you'd like me to.
Before you do, that is how a grown-up engineer, somebody that's become an engineer, thinks, based on the fact that you stood by telling us that you were one of those tinkerers. You took things apart, put them back together. Could you share with our listeners, especially the kids that are listening, could you expand on the tinkering thing of, hey, you may grow up to be an engineer if you .. right now as a kid?
Absolutely. So the common, and I would say wrong, answer to this is I'm good at math and science, right? Like, so typically you get, you know, and this will happen in your high school setting. Somebody will tell you, you're good at math and science, you should be an engineer. And I would say, while that is not bad advice, that is not necessarily the best advice. There are a lot of things you can do by being good at math and science. So what I'm going to say is, if you are the kind of person who likes to solve really hard problems, if you are the kind of person who likes to figure out ways to add additional value into the world, if you're the kind of person who likes to take on the challenge when somebody says, oh, this thing can't be fixed, there's no way we can do this better, right? And you go, oh no, there has to be a way that we can do this better. You need to think about becoming an engineer, right? Because that is what it takes to be an engineer. The math and science and the core fundamental principles are what we engineers build on to do the things I'm talking about: improve, design, add value.
Oh, I think that's excellent. I love that explanation, because, and then the other part of this, to expand upon this, is you can take that engineering thought, you know, way of thinking, and apply it to anything, not just engineering, right?
What's interesting is a lot of engineers only work as an engineer for a short amount of time before they are moved into another role because of the process that we use to think. And because of the way we think, there are a lot of companies and there are a lot of situations where they want people who have an engineering degree, right? So they want people who have an engineering way of thinking. So this could be, you know, engineers will go to law school, engineers will go to med school, engineers will become business leaders in their company. And it's because of this ingrained nature. So yes, you may be an engineer and you may work for an engineer as an engineer for the rest of your life, or you may decide, this was good, I learned a lot through this thinking process, and I'm going to apply it in these ways. Right. And that's a very viable way to do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I do really appreciate, like, Jen, how you explain that. Kids, be thinking about how you're thinking, because that may tell you where you're going to end up later on in life. Now, to get back what you had mentioned before, of you can go into more detail on any one of those avenues of engineering. How about you pick your favorite and dig a little deeper for us?
Okay. So my favorite is without a doubt systems, right? Thinking in systems. And it's because I think this is an area where it's easy to lose sight of this, right? So if I'm asked to improve a system at the university, right? So I teach, you know, here at Colorado Christian. And if I'm asked to think about how could we improve the admissions process or something like that, the admissions process doesn't happen by itself, right? There are a lot of other pieces that come into the admissions process. And we have to think about a lot of different things. So when you're thinking in terms of systems, you're thinking in terms of, what does this thing I'm thinking about, admissions, what does it interact with? Well, it interacts with communication. It interacts with the fact that parents and students and people have lives. It interacts with the technology that goes into sending communications out and receiving communications and having people fill out applications and things like that. So when we're thinking about a system, you have to think about not only the specific problem that you're trying to solve, but right. everything around it that it's going to touch. Everything from a legal standpoint, from a, does it harm the environment standpoint? Is it a business? Is it the right move from a business perspective? So there are all these other pieces that go into systems. And I think that's why systems are so valuable.
Yes, I agree. I think sometimes that's how I write my books. I approach it as a large system. And I start kind of with, okay, I have this topic and what are the things I want to get across? And then how can I do this in a really fun and creative way? Mm-hmm. And that just, like you said, it starts kind of as the center with one question and then it goes out and it can be applied to all the different kinds of things.
Can I give you my second one?
Yes,
oh, please.
Absolutely. Okay.
So my second one would be engineering design, right? We have a lot of students that come in and they want to be designers. Right. Yes. Or they think that they're going to be designers. And there's a big difference sure. between being a designer and being an engineer and being an engine and using engineering design. So
right.
a designer designs a thing that has functional requirements. So they determine what the functional requirements are. So for all of you listening out there, a functional requirement would be if I click this button, it does this thing, right? So this button has a specific function and I think about why that function is there and whether I include the button or whether I don't include the button. Okay. The difference between that and what an engineer does is an engineer says, yeah, okay, this remote needs the button, but what material should I use for the button? Mm-hmm. Should the button be here or should the button be here? And why does that matter when somebody's holding it in their hand? How big should the button be, right? And like how much force should the button require? So we take it almost to a layer deeper from being a designer, okay. right? So a designer is going to figure out those higher level things, which are very, very important. But an engineering designer is going to say, okay, now how do we do that thing, meet that requirement, meet that functional requirement, but how do we do it so it's cost effective? How do we do yes. it so it can be used 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 1,000,000 times, right? Because right. some of the buttons you push forever for, you know, you push for the rest sure. of your life.
And think about, I was just thinking about a mouse, right? Yeah. Like the mouse has to be designed to be pushed. I don't know. Like, could you even imagine how many times a day you push your little mouse key or whatever?
Yeah. And what's cool. So for those listening out there, one of the things that we would do in industrial and systems engineering in particular is we would design tests to have a robot push that mouse button. And we would have that robot push that mouse button 100,000 times, 200,000 times. And then we would do what's called extrapolation, or we would take our data and we would say, okay, if this happened in 200,000 times, can we extend that out? So extrapolation would be extend. Can we extend that out and say, what's going to happen when we push it 1,000,000 times? And then how accurate are we, right? So, because we can't really run every test for 1,000,000 clicks because there's just not enough time in the day and we have other jobs to do. So yes. we would try to do things like that. So it's everything from actually designing that test to analyzing the data on what we think was going to happen if we clicked the button 1,000,000 times instead of 1,000, 100,000 times.
The way you're describing this is fascinating to me and hopefully to our listeners, because having a 10-year-old, they're in that, my daughter and her friends are in that window where they're starting to, I feel like they're thinking the way that you're talking right now and how they would like to, oh, you know what? This thing should have bigger buttons and I would have put it over here. And I don't think that that kids yet are necessarily connecting with, oh, this is how I would like something. Kids that change their room, or, you know, kids that move around the apps on their phones. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're connecting those things that they're actually doing as kids to the engineering process that is what grown-up engineers do.
I would agree with that completely. And that is the first step in the engineering design process. So there is no one engineering design process, but if we look at the general engineering design process, it's going right. to be ask and observe, right? That's yes. our first thing that we exactly. do in that process. So the students you're describing there, or your children, yes. they're asking and observing what's going on in their life and saying, wait, something's not right about this. We need to figure out a better way. Engineering would say, what is that better way? And there's a whole way of thinking and a whole process that allows us to critically analyze that situation and hopefully improve it.
Exactly. Okay. So the third one is what? Value added? We haven't done that one yet.
Yeah. So the third one is we want to create value. So I tell my students this all the time, that we can design the best thing in the world, and if nobody likes it, nobody wants it, and we can't manufacture it in a way that makes sense for the world, it doesn't make any sense, right? We don't want to design the coolest thing that nobody uses. We want to design the coolest thing that somebody's willing to use. So this becomes a pretty interesting mental hurdle for some students to wrestle with, because they say, why wouldn't we want to design the best thing ever? And it's because, okay, the best thing ever can sit on a shelf and it doesn't actually bring any value to the world. So our goal as engineers is, how do we add value? Now, you can add value in a lot of different ways, right? So the one that we always think about first is monetary value. Oh, we make the company money, right? So what do? We make the company money. But there are a lot of other ways to provide value. There are ways to make things simpler. So is there a way that I can do something that adds value by reducing the number of steps I have to do to complete a process? Is there a way that we can reduce waste into a system, right? So either actual tangible physical waste or time waste, right? Like, we have to wait for 30 minutes for this one part of the process. Well, we've added value to the company by reducing waste, time, if we can shorten a process.
Yes.
The other thing that comes into value is when you think, and this ties between value and system, is when you think across the life cycle of a product, right? So engineers, if we're trained well, we think about the life cycle of a product. So I can design an interesting thing, but if there's no what we would call end of life to that product, and there's no way to recycle it, or there's no way to reuse it, or there's no way to dispose of it properly, we're doing harm to the environment. We're not doing well with what we need to be doing. So we think about value, and not just value in the immediate, but value across the entire life cycle. And then how does that connect with everything else? So that's a very, very high level of what I mean when I say value.
Okay. So now that we've talked about all of those different parts, the different segments of engineering, in your work as an engineering educator, now with your PhD, what is the biggest challenge that you see in educating engineers to work through those processes? Is it that part? Is it working through? Is it learning the intricacies? Is it learning all of the interconnectedness of how engineers have to work together?
So the biggest challenge I have, and I spend about the first year. So if you come study with me, right, that I spend about the first year helping work through this. And it's the fact that there is not always one right answer. And there is often never one right answer. It is our job as engineers to figure out the right answer for right now for these people and in this context, right? So
Students don't like that.
It's not their fault, right?
Because it's the way they've been trained.
They've been trained through the K-12 system to that there's a right answer. Okay, I'm going to fill this out and somebody's going to tell me if it's right or wrong. Yep. And a big part of what I do is I say, yes, that model works. In physics, that's the model. In chemistry, that's the model. In math, that's the model. But here, we can design this 10 different ways. We can engineer this 100 different ways. There are better and there are less better, but both will solve the problem that we need to solve. And what is the best way to solve that problem? So the biggest challenge I have is helping students realize it's okay to not really know what you're doing, but know that you're on the right track and that you're getting closer to meeting the goal of adding value in a way that meets the constraints that we have to add value under. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have as you come to the university level and when we're teaching you engineering at the university level. The other one is ambiguity, right? So ambiguity, for those listening, means you don't know all the details. You're trying to figure things out, but nobody presented you with, like, these are all the details of the problem and everything that everybody needs to figure out. And all I have to do is follow the recipe like I'm baking a cake. That is not the real world, right? When we're engineering in the real world, we don't know often more than we know. So we know there's a problem, but we don't know why. We don't know exactly who it impacts. We don't know exactly how it impacts them, but we just know that there's a problem. And our job as engineers is to solve that problem. So a big part of what we do is we try to help students learn ambiguity is okay, embrace it, and do the research. Figure out ask the questions and figure out the answers that you need to figure out in order to be an engineer.
Well, and then let's talk about the other thing that scares students and most people. Failure, right? Failure in engineering is not bad.
No.
Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. So failure in engineering is natural, right? Failure in engineering is a part of the process. There is a mindset in a lot of, like, folks who want to start companies, right? So entrepreneurship and things like that, that it's fail forward fast, right? So the goal is that we're failing, but as we fail forward, which means we're learning as we fail, and we do that process quickly. Now, there's a balance here, right? Because you don't want to fail all the time. If you're failing all the time, that's a problem. Usually that leads to an underlying issue with some fundamental aspect of what you're doing, right? Like, you don't understand the science well enough. You're not doing the math correctly, or you don't understand the business context, right? So, but at the same time, failing forward fast if you're learning and you're not costing the enterprise, whatever it is, company, your sure. own personal status, whatever you're doing, you're not costing them a lot in terms of time or money and attention. You're okay. This is what we want to do. So, mm-hmm. and we call this in engineering, this failure process, we would call it prototyping, right? So, yes. and we would particularly do rapid prototyping. So my job, the first thing I'm going to do is I want to put together the lowest quality product or possible solution that I can at first. And then I want to talk to everybody about it. What does it work? Is it right? Do you think this would work? Do you think this would work? What do you like about it? What don't you like about it? And then as I learned from that process, I learned that, okay, out of the six features I designed, five of them are wrong. Okay, that's fine. I need to redesign those. So in my next prototype, I redesign those and I try to take in everybody's feedback and I try to design it better. So it's, I don't think about it as failure. I think about it as learning. Now, yes. failure in my mind is failure to ask the right questions, failure to ask all of the questions that you need to ask, very and good. Failure to keep going when things get hard. That is failure in my mind.
That is an excellent way of defining failure.
Yes.
A word that needs better definitions than what Webster's just got out there as a finish line, because failure, especially in engineering, is not a finish line at all. And I love the fact that you just reclassified it as prototyping. So kids, next time you quote unquote fail at something, tell mom or dad or teacher you were prototyping.
I was prototyping my first set of answers. Those yeah. were wrong. I need to reevaluate exactly. and resubmit.
Exactly. And then tell them Dr. Corey said so. But the way you were just describing that, I think a lot of us know of the Edison example of I didn't fail, whether it be 1,000 or 10,000, depending on which quote you listen to on as right. But the famous inventor, Thomas Edison, I didn't fail 1,000 times or 10,000 times. I figured out 10,000 ways not to make a light bulb. Okay. And I think that is one that's a quote that's out there that's so ubiquitous that we don't really pay attention to it. But I could hear that quote in my mind as you were describing. When you said you had six criteria that you need to meet and five of them failed, well, the next time you're going to start with one that works, which you're not starting with a clean drawing board again.
And let me make it very clear. Your goal is not to fail, right? Your goal is never right. to fail. So you don't go actively seeking failure.
Right.
But sure. it's more of a shift in the way you think about it that says, more than likely, if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing and I'm pushing the boundaries and I'm really going after adding a lot of value, I'm going to fail. And understanding that that is part of the process and then going from there and improving and improving and improving.
Part of the process.
Yeah. Like, don't think that, oh yeah, like I'm going to go out here and smart companies are supposed to fail. Yeah. But that's actually a natural byproduct of them trying to innovate and them trying to do interesting things. It's not that they were trying right. to fail. No one's trying
right.
to fail.
Right. No. So here's one thing I want you to talk about, because when I've gone to talk to kids in schools and whatever, sometimes they're not really taught economics that much anymore. So talk to us about one of the constraints typically put on an engineer when they're designing a project is money, like mm-hmm. a budget, mm-hmm. and explain how that plays into creating a design and so forth.
Yes. So finances and money come into it in a couple different ways. So one of the ways is it depends on how you start the project. And this is where systems engineering plays into this, because mm-hmm. if you're not talking to the right stakeholders at the very beginning, you potentially design something that somebody comes in and says, that's great, but we can't do that. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough time. We don't
you
have
can't
enough-
sell it for $1,000. No one will buy it.
Exactly. We can't market that product. Right. So this is where you really have to talk to the full range of stakeholders. We would call that systems, right? Thinking in systems. Yes. So that's yes. one way that it comes in. Another way that it comes out in is what we would consider is you make cuts at the end. So I design a feature or a widget or whatever it is, and it has 20 different functions or 20 different features on the widget. Okay. And you know, I present that to the team. The team says, this is great. We can't do that much. We want this product to come out in 6 months. We want this product to come out in right. a year. And the right. 20 is going to take us 3 years. So what can we cut? And that's a way that you say, okay, we're going to cut these things. They're good. They're not bad. They're great. We really want them on there. We just can't do it right now because of finances and because of resources. So you see this a lot in software development, right? You'll see it in physical product development, but you'll see this a lot in software development. They'll talk about what's called a product roadmap. So whether mm-hmm. you're in software okay. or whether you're here, and there are things that they will intentionally pull from the product and put it on the roadmap to do it later when they have more resources, when they have more time, when they have more money, or when the market, when economically it makes more sense to sell that. So they'll hold off features and then they can sell that as a selling point, or they can use that as a selling point later on down the road. So I would say that's primarily the two ways it comes in. It either comes in as a constraint on the front end. We understand that whatever we design needs to meet this budget, or it comes in as a, okay, we're 90% done, but we really need to like knock it back a little bit because of XYZ, you know, whatever the reason is. The cost of this went up, so therefore we can't sell it for as much, or something like that.
That was a great explanation. Thank you.
Yes. Your PhD is money well spent because in terms of engineering education, you really are explaining some of these concepts in a way that I think a lot of people are going to resonate with. This is terrific. Thank you, Dr. Corey. So what I want to, now that you have reached the point that you're at, you are in engineering education, you have your PhD, you are teaching other engineers, what is, and I sort of, I was kind of leading into this earlier, you're at the university level. So you're at Colorado Christian University, you're at the university level. What would you like teachers in the K-12 level to be doing better, to better prepare your students when you get them first year?
So the easy answer to that is math. And I understand they're doing a good job and they're trying as hard as they can with math. And that's good, right? Keep doing that.
Yes. Sure.
But it's the fundamentals of math. So we see students struggle a lot with basic algebra, right? Things like trigonometry, things like linear algebra, those type of things. Is that's where we see students struggle from progressing in the engineering space, right? So it's really interesting how that math sequence makes them feel like they're not capable of being engineers. And it's a shame because it actually is, it has nothing to do with their capability of being an engineer. Just they're struggling with math now, right? Like, and that's okay. Yes. They maybe have never struggled with a class before. So there's a little bit of a confidence issue there. And there's some legitimate, I didn't learn algebra well enough. And that's hurting me in calculus.
Fair.
And that's a reality. I think the second one is, and this is a very big trend right now. So it's happening and it continues to happen. Continue to do more open-ended free range projects. Let students explore things that they want to explore. It's a really hard, so I think in systems, right? So it's a really hard systems problem because a lot of K-12 educators are dealing with large class sizes, not enough resources, and it makes it really hard.
Yes.
But at the same time, the more you can open up and say, go explore something that you really want to explore and improve that. Go explore something that you really want to explore, and we'll figure out how to assess this on the very or in the back end. We'll figure out what your grade's going to be and how that's going to work. And it doesn't have to meet this step-by-step rubric of you get these points here and you get these points here and you get these points here and you get these points here.
Yes.
When you leave my world, when you leave the university world and you go into your job, they don't give you a rubric that says,
no, they don't.
Did you do, you know, it's like that. That's not how the world works. It's here's this project. Go do this project and do it well, and you figure out the rest of it. And there's more and less. I mean, that's more and less true depending on what field you're in, but being more open-ended, allowing more freedom in what you're doing. And I understand it's a really hard problem to solve.
I mean, it is. And I think, you know, teachers do the best they can, but I've seen a lot of them incorporate this, as you said, in their classrooms.
Yes.
I see some of the STEM teachers that are doing this and they're working against a lot of, I mean, they're just told this is what you do. But if you change whatever the experiment is or whatever their design and give them more freedom, not only that, but I think the kids learn more and they're more engaged. And I'm with you. I don't think there's a problem that can't be solved necessarily. You just got to keep working at it, right?
Absolutely.
You just look at it from different angles. Yeah. Okay. So now this is my favorite part. And I'm very interested to hear what your challenge is to our listeners, because this is going to be cool.
Okay. So my challenge to your listeners is when you're just walking around the world, when you're doing whatever you would do in a normal situation, I want you to think of two things. How could I do something better? And what does that thing connect with? So let's say you're sitting at a stoplight and you say, I'm sitting at this stoplight and I've never really thought about the way a stoplight works. And I've never really thought about why the stoplight works this way. How could we make stoplights better? How could we make intersections better? What could we do to improve this situation? And just let your mind stew on all the different ways you could potentially improve that situation. Then take it a step deeper and go, okay, I've thought of ways to improve it. How would those improvements impact everybody involved? So if we go down this stoplight situation, okay, if we improve the stoplight, yeah, how does it impact cars? How does it impact people who are walking down the street? How does it impact people who are riding down the street? How would it impact the police officers who need to get through that stoplight in an emergency? How would it impact the people who need to repair the street or repair the stoplight? And think about all the different pieces and the connections that come into that, because the first activity is asking you to think about value. The second activity is asking you to think about systems. And then the third activity, I want you to come to CCU and I want you to study engineering with me. that's where we'll get to engineering design.
Excellent. I love the way you brought that all the way back to I will see you in class.
Exactly.
Very well done, Dr. Corey.
This has been a really awesome podcast. It's been so much fun having you on the show, Dr. Corey. Thanks so much for being on Solve It for Kids.
Thank you both. It was a pleasure.
Wow, well, as Galactic Space Geek Jeff and space educator at a museum, what an interesting way of looking at engineering through the mind of a PhD engineering educator, explaining how engineers really think through their process.
Yeah, this was a really interesting conversation. And the one thing, I mean, there are so many things to learn, but the one thing that I really loved was his fail forward fast. Right?
And exactly right. Failure in engineering is not really failure as long as you collect more data. Translation, as long as you learn something, you are still working on solving that problem.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And so I am curious to see who does the challenge for this, how you could make something better around your house or do something. I think that would be really interesting. So if you do that, make sure you tag us on our social media, which is at Kids Solve. We are there at Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can leave us a message on our website, which is solveitforkids.com. Don't forget, we actually do a book giveaway if you leave us a comment.
That's right, Jen. And until next time, everybody, keep thinking like an engineer until you hear us on Solve It for Kids.